Now this should be okay. We are first going to finish with the exercise on search. If you remember last time we did 6 examples and the 7th we didn't have time. And I told you that the first thing that we are going to do today will be to do this task. So this is approximate search with NFA, unconstrained approximate search. I have made a couple of changes in the original file and uploaded, so please download it, the newest version from Blackboard. So first of all, it was number 1 here, which doesn't mean anything. In the previous tasks, if you remember, the delta function, there were the initial state numbers missing. So I corrected that, so it's now from 0 to 8, to the leftmost column. And finally, in this particular task, there was one single bit that was wrong, so I corrected that. So what's the problem? We have our pattern, which is annual, you see, and we have search tolerance of 2. Actually, the same problem we have already done the task number 6, but by means of dynamic programming. Now we do the same with automata. So the tolerance is 2, which means this automaton will have 2 plus 1 rows. So the 0th row means no errors, the 1st row means 1 error, and the 2nd row means 2 errors. So if the automaton finds itself in the final state in any of the rows, that means that we have an occurrence. Now if this will be in the 0th row, that will be an occurrence with exact matching, actually, with no errors. If it be in the first row, row number 1, then it will be matching with 1 error. And finally, if the active state will be in the 2nd row, that means, row number 2, that means matching with 2 errors. Still acceptable. Now, it may happen that matching will cause that we have several last positions active at the same time. That's also possible. Okay? Now, we have to run this automaton, and if you remember, the formula was with 2 parts. So the formula, the row-based bit parallelism automaton activity state, active states update formula. We could call it like this. So the formula actually determines which states will be active after processing the given character. And every time we compute the values by means of this formula, we check whether the most significant bit of the state, now we have 3 states. State for the 0th row, the 1st row, and the 2nd row. So if any most significant bit of them will be 1, then we have an occurrence. Now why most significant bit? Because the formula and the automaton, they correspond, but if we mirror the states. So the 0th bit in the formula, the rightmost bit, is actually the next to leftmost bit in the NFA. So these are not present in the status words at all, the 0th row. So we said that in the lecture, but just to, because these are always 1, these are always active, so there is no need to keep them. Now the story is a bit more complicated, because this model is actually not precise enough. There is a PhD dissertation of one Czech scientist from Prague from 2009, I think, Holub, and he actually analyzed these automata, and his automaton has this state and these states.
So starting from the first column, not from the zero column, because these actually do not exist. But in many books you will find just this. So for now, keep it like this. We may comment on this in the next versions of our lectures, but it will not affect the results. So I didn't want to confuse you, but just do it like this. Okay? Now, the first part of the formula is for this zero throw. So that's the exact matching. So it is absolutely the same as shift n. So this is the shift n formula, remember? So there is a shift left, or in with one, and ending with the bitmask. So that's it. Now, the next part, the second part, is actually several parts. The number of these are i's prime. It depends on the rest of the row. So here we have two rows in addition to the zero. So I will go from 1 to 2 in our case. So it would be R1 prime and R2 prime. Of course, the formula for R1 prime and R2 prime will be the same. So it will be, in the case of R1, it will be R1. You see, R1 prime, that's the new state of the row. And R1 is the old state before this character is processed. Now, whenever we compute this, then we actually rotate. So we say that now what was R1 prime, it will be R1 for the next step, for the next character. So that's what we are doing in our material without saying so explicitly. You will see that. But it's assumed. Now, we first have a match, the matching part. So it will be Ri shift left by 1 and ending with a bit mask. And then we have insertion part. So that's just moving vertically. Then we have a substitution part that's moving horizontally. And finally we have the deletion part that's moving, diagonally. And then finally we have the deletion part, which is actually moving diagonally but with these dashed lines. So you see it is R0 prime, it will be for the first row. So the only one that includes the prime, you see, the others are without the prime. So we applied the formula to our problem. Of course, before that we determined the bit mask, but that's something that is done anyway with or without order. So you know this. For A, it will be, of course, mirror again. So A, N, N, U, A, L. So wherever you have an A, then you will have a 1 in the bit mask on that position, mirror. Then N, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, reading from the right. U 0 0 0 1 0 0 from the right, and L 0 0 0 0 0 1 again from the right. So these will be the bit masks, and to the right of this you always have the physical interpretation. So what does this mean? So active machines of the second and the sixth positions always wait for an A. That's how you should read this. Of course, for executing the algorithm you don't have to think about this at all. Just do it. Apply the formula. So, but I would like you to understand why is it. In the beginning, the states are all zeros in the zeroth row, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1 in the first row, and 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1 in the second row. Now, why that? There is also a proof for that.
That if you look at the
machine, so if we say
the active state in the first row, you see,
it will be 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1. Now mirror that.
That would mean
this is active, this one. So it's 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1. And in the second row, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1. Now you see it's a triangle. So everything below this diagonal, including these states on the diagonal, will always be active. So it can be proved. So that's why we have these ones. And this, why is that? Well, the proof actually counts on this loop in the 0-0 state.
So with this it can be explained. But we don't have to go into such details. So this actually is the initialization of our automata.
Now, we start processing the characters of S. So the S is the search string. So the first character that arrives is A. So the search string is annealing. And the search pattern is annual. Now the machine always corresponds to the search pattern, never to the search string. We don't know the search string in advance. So we have the first character to process is A. Now the first part of the formula is for the zeroth row, so our zero prime will be shifted. So the mask is 010001, read from the left side. So we have the initial state is 0, the initial state of the search status word corresponding to the 0th row, it will be all zeros, shift by 1, all zeros again, all with 1, create a new machine, waiting for the character A. Okay, so it will actually match this one, the last one in the bit bus, so that will mean that the active bit will be 0 bit after this. So it will be 0000001, the 0th row. So that's the first part of our formula for the 0th row. Now we have the first row, which is more complicated. It has 4 parts, and at the end you are with 1 in addition to all that. So this can be actually written in a different way, the formula. But we don't have to discuss all these details. So the formula can be transformed in a bit to conform more to the physical interpretation. So this OR can be moved here, and then it will be just shift end. That will have the same effect. Anyway, you don't have to think about it. So ORing with 1 here is the same as ORing with 1 here. So we can write the formula exactly as it is the zero for the 0th row. But, well, this sounds, I don't know, more appealing to just add 1 at the end, or with 1 at the end. So our situation is the R1 prime, that's the new value for the status word for the first row, okay, is obtained by ORing 4 parts. And this one is the 5th part, but it's not physical. See? So you have the match is shifting the old value of the status word by 1, ending with the bit mask. That's the match. Then we have the insertion, vertical transition. Then we have the substitution, diagonal transition. And we have the deletion, which is diagonal transition, but you see R0 prime. That's without consuming the character. So that's the epsilon transition. And then, so when we substitute all that, R1 initially was, as we said, this one is because the diagonal is always active. So we have this one shifted by 1, ending with the bit mask, which is for an A 010001. So that's what we are going to compute. So this, when we shift, it will be 000010, and then end with something that doesn't have matching ones of these positions where this one has, so it will be all zeros. So it will be like this. It will be 000010, and then you end with the bit past, which is 010001. You see, you are ending. So you must have 2 ones for this to be 1, so everything will be 0. So this is how we obtained this value. Okay? So, just apply the formula. So that was the match, that was the insertion. R0, you know, it's not the R0 that we have just computed. That what we have computed is R0 prime. But the old value for R0 was all zeros. That's the initial value. Then the same, but shifted by 1. That's actually the substitution. Since it was 1, it was all zeros, this must be all zeros. And then ORing with, you know, now R0 prime, but shifted by 1. We have computed R0 prime was 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, shift by 1 position to the left, and finally OR with 1. So when we execute all this compute, you see a lot of zeros, but still we have 1 on the second position from the right and 1 on the first position from the right. So the new state for the first row will be 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1.
Similarly, for the second row, we have R2, the old version of the second row, shifted by 1, ended with the bit mask for an A, which has arrived, and ORing with R1, which is insertion, ORing with R1 shifted by left by 1, that's the substitution, and ORing with R1 prime, which is this, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, shifted by 1, and finally ORing with 1. So when we substitute all that compute, we get 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1. So after receiving the first character of the search string, our machine looks like this. So we have R0 prime, which is 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1. So I'm going to write it from the reverse angle. So it will be 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. Why? Because now we are talking NFA. So the NFA is actually the reverse. And then for R1, we have this, 1, 1 and 4 zeros. See? 1, 1 and 4 zeros. And for R2, we have 1, 1, 1 and after that, 3 zeros. So our all zero state is, our loop state is actually here, to the left of all this. So it's not in the bits of the status words. You see? So after processing the first bit, we are here. So we are waiting to find any of these to be 1. Then we have an occurrence. Now, after this step that we have just performed, this has to be checked. So is there a 1 on the MSB of this? No. Actually, in the NFA, it's the reverse. So, no. Which means we don't have occurrence yet. Of course, we have just processed 1 symbol. So, and this is explicitly written in your material. So the 1 symbol vectors Ri determine the active states of the NFA after processing a symbol from S. Note that we have to mirror the vectors, that's what we have just done. And note also that the leftmost column of the NFA is not present. So we have commented on this. And this is because we know that all the states in this column are all the same. So, and then we check for the MSB, and this check will give us that there is no active MSB, which means we process the next symbol, which is N, you see? But now we have to rotate. Now R0 prime will be R0, R1 prime will be R1, R2 prime will be R2. So when we say here, when we say here, this is the 1. When we say here R0, that's actually the R0 prime from the previous step. We have rotated that. Now, the same way, but now the bit mask will be different. Since it is N, the bit mask is 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0. Okay? Now, the R0 from before, it was 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1. That's this one. Shift left, or with 1, and with the bit mask, and we get this, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0. You see? So the new one
will be
000010. I'm writing from the right. 000010.
See, that will be the new state of the zero point.
R1 prime, R1 that we have computed is this, 000011. You see? Shift left by 1, and with the bit passed, which is 000110, or with 1, which is the insertion. So that's ORing with this one, with this bit. So that's the vertical transition. Then we have ORing with the same row, but shifting left by 1, that's the substitution. So these. And finally, ORing with what we have just computed, but shifted by 1, so that's the deletion. So when we substitute that, this should be all right, because I have just checked all the bits, so it should be correct. So 000111. When we write it the reverse, in the reverse order, we have 11100. So that will be the new state of the R1. And finally, R2, the new state, R2 old was this one, 000111, okay? Shift by 1, and with the bit pass, 000110, then OR with insertion, now it's this row, OR with these bits, the old values for R1, and then OR with the same but shifted by 1 position, that's diagonal. And finally, OR with this shifted by 1. So this part, that's the deletion. And finally, OR by 1, we OR with 1, we have already explained why here. And what we get is actually 001111 mirrored is 11110. So we have a lot of active bits in the row number 2. So still no MSBs active. We process the next character the same way, and by following the same procedure we get for the 0th row 000100, for the first row 001111, and for the second row 011111. Okay? So that will be, but still without the MSB. So there will be no MSB active. Then you see this one is characteristic. So now we have received ANN. Now instead of UE has arrived. So what happens? So our state from before, it's now not on the blackboard. The blackboard is after the first N, and our current state is after the second N. We will find this in the material. So you have R0, which is 000100. Okay? Shift by 1, OR with 1, and with, you see, bit mask for E is all zeros. Why? Because E is not in the pattern. Of course, the result will be all zeros. So this actually will make our state of the first of the zero row, yeah, to be all zeros. Now what happens with the subsequent rows? So the first row, the previous state was 001111, shift by 1. Now and with all zeros the same thing, so this part will be zero. And then insertion, then substitution, and then the deletion is just all zeros, because we have just computed that zero drop, and OR with 1, what we get is, you see, non-zero. It will be 001101. When we write it in the reverse order, it will be 101100. Okay. Finally, R2, following the same procedure, you see, it's always ending with a bit mask for an E, which is all zeros, we get this. So a lot of ones. Now when we write it in the reverse order, but still no active MSB. Now A has arrived. A is in the pattern. So this will cause that we, for R0 prime, we get 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1. Then for R1 prime, we get 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1. And for R2 prime, we get, you see, all ones. So what does that mean? So the state after this will be 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0 for the second row. I'm writing everything backwards. Now R1, 1, 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, and R2 will be all ones. And this is an active MSB, which means we have got an occurrence. Now what is detected as occurrence? It is ANNEA, exactly what we have received so far. Why? Because it is at the added distance of 2 from the pattern. So if the pattern is ANNUAL and we have ANNEA, you see? Now this is a deletion and this is a substitution. And the other symbols are the same, so their contribution to the distance is 0. So we have the distance, the added distance equal to 2, and since our k is 2, then we have an occurrence. So this is an acceptable string. Now the machine just reports on this and continues processing the characters because there may be more matches. So that's what the machine will actually do. Process the L character, you see, from the search tree, L has arrived. We do the same as before, R0 prime will be now all zeros. Why is that? Because the previous state was 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, shift by 1, or with 1, that will be 1, 1. But end with 1 and all zeros, that will give 0. So it will be 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. Now R1 prime will be this. After substituting all this, will be 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1. You see, MSB is active. And R2, again, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1. As I said, there may be more rows with MSB active anyway. And why is that? Because now we have matched A and N U A L, which is our pattern, with this A N N E A L. You see? Now, what is different? The only thing that is different is this. D is 1. You see? So it is our second row, actually. The distance, if you want really to compute the distance out of the machine, it will be equal to the row where to the row with the smallest index that has MSB active. Okay? So in our case, the distance will be 1, even though the first and the second row have MSB active. So that's ANNEAL, you see this one, that's the new acceptable string. So before it was a knee, now it's a kneel, you see. But we continue processing. You see, we have an I on input. When we substitute and compute the formula, R0 still all zeros, R1 prime, it will be 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, but R2 prime will still have MSB active, which means this thing is also acceptable. Why? Because it's a NEALI, you see? So we have, if you add I here, then it's an insertion. You see, now D will be
2, which is less than or equal to k. So this is still acceptable.
Finally, we have the two n and g that derived, so these will not
change the number of encountered occurrences. So you see, after processing the next to last n from the search string, we shall have the three states that don't have one on the NSB for n, and for g either. So it will be a situation that we shall not have occurrence. Why? Because annealing is not acceptable. It will be the distance 4. And annealing will be the distance 3. So we have to insert these characters, n and g. So this cannot be done because it's more than k.
So that's something that I wanted to show you, how this works.
I have edited the previous version of the file, uploaded it in Blackboard. This should be correct. But anyway, if you think that something is wrong here, let me know, because all this copy-paste of bits will be error-prone. It's possible to have some errors. So let's have a 5 minutes break to switch the presentations, and then we talk about the clustering. And I would like to know what is the difference when the field is the first one is 0 or when the field is 1, 2, 3.
Ah, this is for the search.
Yes.
So when it is search, you have the first row all zeros, and this reflects the fact that you can start searching from any position in the search string.
Okay.
So that's why it is all zeros.
Okay.
Okay. That would mean before you match the first character of your pattern in the search string, you may have several symbols processed that don't mean anything. They don't contribute to the distance.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
if we are all ready, then we can start with our subtopic. Last time we talked about statistical methods, but parametric of intrusion detection, anomaly detection actually in particular. Now we are going to talk about non-parametric statistical methods in anomaly detection. So that's our second subtopic. And next time on Tuesday, we are going to talk about machine learning methods of anomaly detection. And with this, we complete this topic. So, there will be four parts in this short lecture, I would say 2 hours. Introduction, non-parametric anomaly detection methods, something very general about that. Then cluster analysis, most of our lecture will be on this. And labeling clusters, which is actually closely related to cluster analysis in anomaly detection, the last, say, 10, 11 slides. So, if you remember last time we talked about parametric anomaly detection, which means that the underlying distribution of data is known. Well known, I would say assumed. Because as we are going to comment on, it's actually difficult to say that it is really that distribution. We'll talk about that a bit later. So, it's usually assumed that it is normal Gaussian, well, normal or Gaussian distribution. Why is that? Because most processes in nature follow this distribution. So why should any other computer science project or process would be different? Now it turns out to be different, as we are going to see. So what happens if the assumption about the distribution is wrong? Then we get false positives in addition to false positives that we already have. So there will be even more false positives. Now, what if it is not Gaussian distribution? The thing is that it is difficult to determine the underlying distribution. We said last time, actually, that it is possible to perform statistical tests. But the statistical test will tell you that it is this distribution with high probability or something like that. So we can interpret it like this. It's not precisely mathematically correct what I'm saying, but it's more or less common sense would tell you this. So it's most probably Gaussian distribution or most probably uniform distribution or something, but it is actually supported by the data. Now you change the data and you may get different results. That's the problem of statistics in general. Okay? So you sample your data in the first hour of traffic, if we are talking about computers, networks, and you get statistical tests performed on this, and you get that this distribution is Gaussian. You can compute, you know this from bachelor studies, Kolmogorov-Smirnov test, for example, something like that, and you get this. Now, it's probably Gaussian. Now, you sample again, and the thing is that if you perform the test again, you get a different result. So that's a problem. It's actually difficult to determine the underlying distribution. So that's why we say that the underlying distribution of data is assumed to be Gaussian. Nobody has checked that. And it's difficult to check. Deterministically, it's not possible at all. So the check is probabilistic. Now, there were some results, scientific results, showing that the resource utilization variables, for example, these are actually random variables, okay, are not normally distributed. So I have uploaded that particular paper, but there are several papers on this. Yeah? So that was actually the case for abandoning parametric statistical decisions. So it was justified at that time, so it's not that bad, as bad as people were saying and are saying, that it's still possible to use parametric methods. Now, anyway, if you don't guess you don't assume the right distribution, you get a problem with false positives. And for these resource utilization variables, it has been shown, and etc. etc. proved actually that these are not Gaussian, like CPU time, memory consumption, things that we usually mention in our classes, because every operating system can give you a graph on this. Yeah. You can sample this very easily. Consequently, there were proposals what to do next. And the first paper that appeared about using non-parametric statistics, the proposal to use that, appeared already in 1991 by this Linda Lankiewicz and her team. So they actually proposed to use non-parametric statistics, and if you read that paper that is also in Blackboard, there is already a system doing this. So, but of course, the computers of that time were quite different, so you have something that is not directly practically applicable to today's situation, but as an idea it serves. In particular, it's good to use cluster analysis. First of all, if we are talking about non-parametric statistics, that means that you don't need to know underlying distribution. You don't have to assume anything. In fact, if you have different variables, they all can have different distributions, as is the case with this. So if you remember last time we talked about IDES and IDES, and we said that, for example, CPU time, memory consumption, they are random variables that are used there, but also some other random variables for which the assumption on Gaussian distribution is good. But for these particular, it's bad. So they may have different distributions. You don't care because you don't need distribution at all. So still, it is possible to make what we need in cluster analysis and in pattern recognition in general, in supervised learning as well, as we are going to see next time. We need to make feature vectors. So each component of the feature vector is a random variable in this case, measuring something like CPU consumption, memory consumption is another variable, etc., etc. So that's how it works. Another advantage over other methods is that these are usually fast, these procedures. Actually, there are very fast cluster analysis procedures. Today we are going to concentrate on cluster analysis. It's non-parametric, but it's unsupervised. You see, there are no labeled data here, no training. So these methods are fast. Time complexity, for example, of some clustering methods like k-means, about which we are going to talk mostly, is linear in the number of data points. Data point is the same as feature vector. As we said last time, we are going to switch terminology between statistics and machine learning. So, a data point is actually a data point in an n-dimensional space. So each of our components of the feature vector determines one coordinate of that point. So we can say that it's a data point, or we can say that it's a feature vector. It's the same. So we are clustering these data points, making some groups. And these algorithms that are efficient, their time complexity is linear in the number of these data points. So if you double the number of data points, the CPU time will be double. It's good. Now, it's not good enough for IDS, as it turns out. And why is that? Because IDS, as we know, have to operate in real time, so as fast as possible. And even though these methods are fast, they must be made even faster to be practically usable. And to this end, for some of these algorithms, we have acceleration methods that make them even sublinear in time. In addition, we can parallelize that. So we can use distributed architectures like Hadoop, things like that. So that makes them even faster. We're only going to mention that in this course. We don't have so much time for this. But you have to know that it is possible to parallelize that and use distributed architecture to implement. And actually, it's a new trend. We are going to show that the results on this are from this year. What else can we do instead of using parametric statistics? We can use expert systems. Now, expert systems were popular probably before you were born in the 1980s. Now, this was solution of all the problems. Everybody was saying this is going to replace humans. Now, you have in an expert system, you have a knowledge engineer interviewing an expert and converting his or her knowledge into a knowledge base, which is called the database of the system. This is called the knowledge base, and then the system, using algorithms and some heuristics, the system makes decisions on the real situation. Is it good or bad in our case to recognize which is bad traffic, which is good traffic? No. But any other problem can be modeled in this way. Now, of course, it didn't work. So today nobody is mentioning expert systems. But for this, to make an expert system for intrusion detection, like intrusion detection expert system, IDES, which was parametric, but you can do it in a non-parametric way as well. So you have to engage a knowledge engineer, and then you must have an expert for networks, and the networks are complicated. There is not such a thing like a general network. So every network is different, every computer system is different, so this is not possible in practice. In addition, it's mostly manual labor to interview an expert. And because of that, it's slow. Slow. Cannot operate in real time. So forget about expert systems. In other attempts to solve this problem was, for example, if you issue a command. We have discussed that when we talked about parametric systems as well. When you issue a system command on the console of your operating system, actually there is a lot of system calls that are executed. And we can monitor the sequences of these system calls, and there have been attempts to determine whether the sequence of commands is good or bad by monitoring these sequences of system calls. Well, it has been popular 25 years ago, but still this metric only by itself is not enough. So it's not rich enough to reliably detect anomalies. And because of that, the interest has been reduced in this. So these are other possibilities in addition to non-parametric statistics. Now, to present days, we have to rely on non-parametric statistics. So clustering, especially clustering, is still considered possible to use in intrusion detection and is used. Now, recall, what are the requirements for an anomaly detection system? We need a system that doesn't generate too many false positives. That's the one of the requirements. And the second one is that it is efficient enough, which means if it is not efficient enough, we don't use it, because either it detects the intrusion now or it doesn't detect it. So we have to do it in real time. So we need real-time operation. We need small number of false positives. Now, how do we reduce the number of false positives? We said something about that in the very first lecture, and later during the course we have mentioned that several times. So we have to make the settled metrics of normal behavior rich enough. So translated to our terminology, that would mean increase the dimensionality of feature vectors. So our feature vectors will contain more components, because you have to measure more aspects of system behavior to define normality more precisely. Now, the consequence of this is good and bad. So the good consequence is that it will reduce the number of false positives. The bad consequence is that it introduces computational overhead. It's not the same if you compare two vectors of the length 1,000 and two vectors of the length 10. Even though it's linear relationship, still If you have to do a lot of things linearly, when you have 10 billion things, it's a lot. Because the number of records, that the number of feature vectors is huge. Today's bandwidth is very, very wide, you see? And that's a lot of traffic. If we are talking network intrusion detection, if we are talking host intrusion detection system, there are a lot of users and a lot of aspects of their behavior. So this will be costly, increasing the feature space. Now, how do we achieve real-time operation? By reducing the amount of data to cluster. So we can either reduce the number of feature vectors, but that would not be, we have to skip some feature vectors. That's bad, because then we have false negatives. What remains is reducing the dimensionality. So we measure less aspects of normal behavior, which means there is one requirement to increase the number of features and another requirement that requires to reduce the number of features. So to achieve real-time operation, reduce the number of features. To achieve a small number of false positives, increase the number of features. So that's something that we have to deal with. So the result is that we need a trade-off between these two requirements. And for this, we have to choose the features that are most relevant. That process is called feature selection. Now, this is a science by itself. So there are books about this, just feature selection. So how do we choose relevant features? Of course, this is not a course on feature. We could have a course on feature selection, whole semester talking about feature selection only. So that's a lot of science here. So what is feature selection? It is reduction of the dimensionality of feature vectors in such a way that we get almost the same results with a large number of features and with this reduced number of features. Now, once we reduce the number of features and get more or less the same results, that would mean that we would be faster. So it will not jeopardize the real-time operation efficiency that is needed in the IDR. So feature selection process is very, very important. We are, of course, not going to talk about this. So we are always going to assume that somebody has chosen features for us. But you have to know that there is a big process behind getting the vectors. Which will take us to defining an IDS as a classifier, where we have at least two classes, but we may have more. So that's the most, the coarsest way of looking into an IDS. So at least two classes, one is normal and the other is abnormal. Okay, so we may have normal traffic class and abnormal traffic class if it is a network-based intrusion detection system. Now, we sometimes need a fine-grained classification where we ask the questions like, if this is an attack, what kind or what category of attack is it? For example, is it denial of service? Is it something like user to root or something? Or is it an isolated attack? Or is it what I would call a burst attack or massive attack, so like scene flood, where you have 10,000 feature vectors the same? That would be a finer classification to more into more classes. So the feature selection that we have mentioned would tell us what features of raw data to use. We have to select only relevant features, which means those that are not redundant. In addition, sometimes it's better to use less features, as they say in these books on feature selection, less is more. So we get better results with less features than with the full, that's what is called full feature set, when we use all aspects of raw data for our classification. So that would be full feature set. Now, how to get these reduced feature sets? We can use some statistical methods, or we can use expert knowledge, which is often the case. In the case of intrusion detection, it's always good to have an expert at hand, and then we can combine the expert knowledge with statistical methods as well. Now that would be feature selection. In addition to that, we have to resolve for non-numerical data. And this is an example that is characteristic. So one of the features may be the protocol name. So it may be TCP, UDP, ICMP. But what is the similarity between protocols? There is no similarity at all. It makes no sense to compare TCP and UDP. So is TCP closer to ICMP than UDP? It makes no sense. So this is something that we are going to discuss next time as well, because this is an important question. So we have to solve this, and this is more technical. More theoretical is the selection features. Of non-parametric methods that are used, most often used is clustering, because it's fast. And you don't need training. Now we start with clustering. So what is clustering? Of course, in our realm, in anomaly detection, it is a method to group feature vectors obtained from raw data into classes in an unsupervised way. In such a way that members of each class are as close as possible to each other, and the different classes are as far apart as possible or as dissimilar as possible from each other. So that's a natural way to look at these things. Now, in the clustering terminology, a class is a cluster. But it's classification, some form of, because it will partition our raw data set into some classes, but without learning, without training. Formal definition is given on the slide 12, where we consider a set of feature vectors, call it X. The cardinality of this set is M, so we have M feature vectors. The elements of this set are X1 to XM. The dimensions of these vectors are N1 to NM, respectively. Most often we talk about the same length, but it doesn't have to be so in general. So X1 is of length N1, XM is of length NM. The task is to partition this set X, optimizing some function that is called a partition criterion. And we partition this set into K subsets, call them C1 to CK, such that these two relations code. When we take the union of all these classes, clusters, we get the original set X. And in addition to that, because this only would permit that the clusters are mutually are not mutually exclusive, so that we have a kind of intersection. Now, the second condition is that it's not the case. So if you take any two clusters, the intersection between them is an empty set. So there is no overlap between the clusters. So that's the requirement. So this is classical clustering. We have a method that is called fuzzy clustering, where we permit that some entity may belong to both, to three clusters. But that's another kind of story. So we are not going to talk about this. So this is classical clustering, in which one vector is assigned to one cluster, but not to any else at the same time, any cluster else at the same time. If you remember, in the first lecture, we talked about the structure of an IDS. So the clustering algorithm would actually be the detection algorithm. That's one application of clustering. We can do something else with clustering. For example, this is just a digression. We can use a misuse detection system, and instead of data records from the database treating separately, we can group similar data records and get less records. So instead of comparing traffic vectors with the database records, we can compare them with the representatives of the classes, of the clusters. That's data reduction. And for that comparison, we need actually approximate search. So it's all related. But in this context, we are talking today about clustering being actually the detection algorithm. So you get the raw data and you classify them whether these data are good or bad. There are two main groups of clustering algorithms, hierarchical and non-hierarchical or partitional. We are going to call them partitional algorithms. It's easier for me to pronounce. Okay, otherwise you can call them as you like. So these hierarchical are less efficient than partitional. Their time complexity with respect to the number of feature vectors is quadratic. And these partition algorithms have one weak point, and that's that the result of clustering often depends on the initial partition. But there is a workaround to that, so that's a known problem. We need a trade-off between correctness and efficiency. So correctness would be at least number of false positives, and efficiency would be requirement for real-time operation. And with the cluster analysis, the same applies. So we need a cluster analysis algorithm that is capable of ensuring real-time operation and also generating as small number of false positives as possible. We are going to say something very, very short about hierarchical clustering methods. What is the idea? We start from the initial set of feature vectors to cluster and then construct a tree-like data structure that is called hierarchy or dendrogram. Because it's tree, dendros, that's tree in Greek. In each step of any hierarchical clustering algorithm, we actually join the most similar clusters from the previous step. That's called agglomeration. And we get a new cluster. Then the procedure starts with each feature vector representing one class and ends in one only class, which is the root cluster, single cluster. So, in addition to agglomerative procedures for this, we may have actually divisive procedures. That's not very often, but it's possible to start with taking everything and then dividing each time, so going backwards. But usually we start from the feature vectors. In this example on the slide 17, we have five feature vectors, and in each step we find the two most similar ones. In our first step it will be 4 and 5. Now the step is over, you see. So this is characteristic for this method. Actually, this is the classical way of looking at things. There is a variant where we can do more in one step, but not on this. So, first of all, we join 4 and 5, because these two are most similar of all. Now, in the next step, the 1 is the most similar to this. You see, we are comparing a feature vector and a cluster. The question is how we are going to say that. In the next step, we have 2 and 3, which are the most similar. And finally, well, the only that remains is to join these two groups, and we get 1. So this is how it works. Remember that it's only 1 agglomeration per step, not more than 1. Now, what is the advantage of this over the partitional? It's lower, obviously, because we have quadratic. We have to compare everything with everything. Here, we need the similarity matrix, implicitly or explicitly, but we need it. It's quadratic in the number of vectors. Now, the advantage over partitional is that we have all the possible numbers of clusters after we complete this. We may have, in our case, 5 clusters, or 4 clusters, or 3 clusters, or 2 clusters, or 1 cluster. Then we can use some criterion to determine which number of clusters is the best. We are going to discuss that at the end today, what clustering is good. So you just cut this tree at the level that corresponds to the step. Now I called it 0 step, it's actually the initialization. So in the beginning you have every cluster containing 1 feature vector. So in that case, we have the number of clusters equal to the number of feature vectors. Then we agglomerate, So in the next step, we have four clusters, and then we agglomerate again. In the next step, three clusters, etc., etc. So that's what we get with hierarchical and not with partitional. So that's why it is sometimes good to use this. Now, first of all, in non-hierarchical, we partition the given set of feature vectors into the given number of clusters, but we have to know how many clusters in advance. Somebody has to tell us. According to some criterion function or objective function, it's optimization. We may minimize this function or maximize it, depends on the function. The criterion function reflects the requirement for compact, well-separated clusters. So the members of the cluster have to be very similar between themselves, that's compactness, and well-separated, which means the clusters should be distant. Before clustering, we have to solve two problems. Determine the appropriate number of clusters, how many clusters, and to determine the appropriate similarity measure or distance measure. When we said we are agglomerating two most similar vectors, but what is the measure of their similarity? Now, in addition to these two, we may also put the third requirement to determine the function to optimize. But very often it's one same function, we are going to see that. So it's not that important. So what is important is the distance and the number of clusters. In hierarchical case, the cluster problem is number problem is solved by definition. You may have as many clusters as you wish. Once you get the dendrogram, you can cut it where you like. So you don't have to take care so much about the number of clusters. On the other hand, for partitional methods, you cannot start clustering without knowing the number of clusters. That's the problem. Now, we said we have to compare sometimes a vector with a cluster or two clusters. What is their similarity? So there are many ways to do this, many measures of similarities between clusters. One of them is single linkage, which means join clusters with two most similar vectors. You find the smallest distance between the vectors, one of which pertains to one cluster and another to another cluster. So that's called single linkage. The opposite case is so-called complete linkage. You join the clusters with two most distant vectors. And of course there is something in between, average linkage, there are some others. The similarity or distance measure between vectors may be, in most cases, if they are of the same length, Euclidean distance, that you all know. And for unequal length vectors, edit distance. So we have used that with our search, approximate search technique, so we can use that for comparison of vectors that are in general not of the same length as well. For partitional methods, of course, the cluster numbering problem has to be solved separately. We can do it in many ways, for example, by trial and error. We can use some clustering quality criterion about which we are going to talk a bit later, and we try the value of this criterion for every possibility of cluster numbers from 1 to n, m in our case, m. We use that terminology. So choose what is the best. Now, this will be a general case. In intrusion detection, however, we are often forced to use k equal to 2 because it's good and bad. So even though the clustering quality criterion would say it's good to have 5 clusters, we are not interested in that. We need 2. So that's about the cluster numbering problem, the cluster number problem. The second problem is the distance measure, which is the same as with hierarchical. We can use Euclidean distance, we can use edit distance. Now, of all these clustering methods, we are going to focus on one partitional method, which is called the k-means clustering. It is the most often used partitional clustering method in practice. Why? Because it's fast. It's easy to implement, it converges rapidly. You can speed it up to be even sublinear in time complexity using the triangle inequality. We are going to talk about that today. And we can implement it on distributed architectures like Hadoop, Spark, Flink, and some others. So this is perspective. On the other hand, there are some weaknesses of this algorithm. One of them is that it is so-called greedy algorithm, so which means it always takes the maximum increase in the optimization in the objective function, and when you start at one point, it will end up in the nearest extreme value, minimum or maximum. So if you have an objective function which is multimodal, so-called multimodal, that means this would be a unimodal function. It only has one maximum. Now, if you have more, something like this, and you initialize your search here, so it will take you here. This is the local maximum, but not the global one. To get the global one, you have to reinitialize and run it again. So that's the characteristic of the greedy algorithm. So it will find the local, in our case, minimum, actually, not maximum, doesn't matter. This was just an example of a multimodal function optimization. You know. There are PhD theses about that and books. So there is a lot of research on this, how to find this one in a huge space. So we are talking about big data. And for big data, there are many possible solutions that don't work, and only one that works if it exists. If you have a petabyte of data, what can you do? You have linear algorithms, sublinear algorithms, but still it's too slow. So we find the local minimum of the criterion function. The local minimum depends on the initial partition. We can partition initially in many ways. And very often, we just try many initial partitions, take 100 of them. But if the function has the distribution of these local extrema very strange, sometimes you don't get what you want. Because the function may be like this. Have a peak, and then something like this, have another peak. So how can you initialize this? Or it may have something like this. This is a good case. So whatever you do, you get the maximum. It's very difficult to find the solution in this case, because the probability that you guess a good starting point is close to zero. It all depends on the data, actually, that you have. So there are some research results on this. For example, in Blackboard you will find this paper that describes how you can intelligently initialize k-means. That's the algorithm called k-means++. Sounds interesting, but of course in this case nothing works in the case of these peaks. Regarding the objective function or the partition criterion function, very often, in most cases, you use this sum squared error, SSE, which is actually, you see, the sum of squares of the distances between the vector pertaining to the cluster J and the centroid of that cluster. We are talking about centroids or centers in the case of k-means, because you have a representative of each cluster that is called centroid. So you have some clustering, you take all the vectors pertaining to one cluster, compute the distance between these vectors and the centroid, corresponding centroid, square this, sum for all the vectors, and then sum over all clusters. And you get this sum squared error. So you have to minimize it, find the minimum of this function. So mu j is the representative or centroid of the cluster Cj, And the distance d of xi mu j is the value of the distance measure, we didn't say which one, between the feature vector xi belonging to the cluster cj and the centroid mu j of cj. So it's all clear from the slide 25. There are two variants of the k-means clustering, of which one would be very good to use in the IDS, but it's slow, and one is not so good for use in IDS, and it's fast. Unfortunately, it's all opposite of what we want. So, so-called offline or batch k-means algorithm consists of course, you must have all the vectors in advance for this. Take, for example, 1,000 vectors and choose k feature vectors by means of some initialization algorithm. You can use it at random to define the initial centroids. So the initial centroids are very often really the vectors from the feature vector set. Otherwise, the centroids are not, as you're going to see. Now, take the centroids. For example, we have two clusters. So you need two vectors to play the role of the centroids. Now assign each feature vector to its closest centroid, you get two clusters. Now move the centroids, that's called moving centroids. So compute the new centroids. And the new centroid of each cluster is the mean of the vectors in this cluster per coordinates. You compute the mean of each coordinate, you get the centroid. Of course, this centroid does not necessarily belong to the original feature vector set, but you don't care. And iterate that until you get into a situation where no vector changes the cluster. That's convergence. So this is the offline algorithm. You must have all the vectors in advance. On the other hand, the original, actually, k-means, and why it was called k-means, because it will compute the mean of the vectors in the cluster. It's due to McQueen in 1967, so that's 50 years ago. Online k-means, where you have initially no vectors, and then one vector arrives, two vector arrives. If you need two clusters, you proclaim them centers or centroids. And then for each new vector that arrives, assign it to the nearest centroid, and then compute the new centroid, you see? So at arrival of each new vector, you compute the new centroids. That's a lot of computation. You have to compute the centroids much more often than with the offline version, in which you only compute the centroid after assigning all the vectors to the closest center. And here, since you don't have all the vectors in advance, you have to do it each time one vector arrives. So that's a lot. On the other hand, it resembles our situation with IDS. Our feature vectors are traffic, packet sessions, and the information extracted from them. Each time we get one feature vector, we would like to classify it and then compute the new center. So that will be exactly our situation. The thing is that it is too slow. So this is obviously slower than offline, but it is convenient for real-time online operation, which is actually IDS. Now, consider our network. If this is fast enough for the bandwidth that we have, that's ideal. We can use it. On the other hand, if it is too slow, we have to do it in batch mode, which means that's never real-time operation. You take 1,000 or 2,000 vectors to classify, but you accumulate first them, then you classify, but then you are lagging behind sometime between this situation and the real situation. So batch is fast, but is not exactly ideal for intrusion detection. This would be better. This is very similar to something that we are going to mention next time in machine learning, which is called self-organizing maps. With neural networks, it's almost equivalent to this part of this form of k-means. But we are going to discuss that next time. Here is an example. Okay, we'll do it after the break. So we start at 11:50. Okay.
This course isn't 2:12, it's 2:13.
Sorry?
Today it's 2:12 or
2:13?
2:1.
We always start at 10:15 and end at 1.
It's not what it says on the schedule.
Sorry?
It's not what they say on the schedule. They say that it finishes at 12.
No, that's not true. 12?
Yes. I was also surprised.
Strange. Okay, we'll finish at 12.
No, it doesn't.
Shouldn't be the case. We should have 3 hours, not two.
I mean, usually every week it's like 3 hours, and just this week it's like 2 hours.
Ah, it will not be the case. Okay. But anyway, I think we are going to finish earlier.
The mean of each coordinate, you can calculate from them. Each time
it's just surprises. I have seen it.
Yeah, I was in my agenda. It says 3 hours. Still, we'll make it. Maybe not in exactly 2 hours, but 2 hours and a half.
Hold on.
Yes, I'm a tea,
Shall we continue? As we said, the online K-means would be actually ideal for application intrusion detection systems because we don't have all the vectors in advance. Unfortunately, this one is slower than the offline, so we have to take care about real-time operation. So from now on, we are going to concentrate on batch, on offline processing, because we may still use offline in intrusion detection, but not for absolutely real time. Regarding the distance measure that we are going to discuss now, the most important requirement for the distance measure, because you can introduce any kind of distance, is that it must be a metric. And metric mathematically means the first three conditions are actually trivial. So for every vector a and b, the distance is greater than or equal to zero. If it is zero, then a and b are equal. The symmetry, the distance between a and b, is the same as the distance between b and a. But what is really important here is that the triangle inequality must hold, which means that for the three vectors a, b, and c, the distance between a and c must be less than or equal to the sum of the distances between a and b and b and c. So, you know triangle inequality from primary school, but not every measure that we may proclaim a distance obeys this. So, we have to check that. We actually have to prove that our distance is the metric first before we do anything else. Now, distances that are often used are, in general, Minkowski metric, which is the qth square, the qth root of the sum of the qth powers of the differences between the components of the vectors. Okay? Now, there are special cases of which q equal to 1 is often used, especially in the binary case, where we have Hamming distance. So, the q is 1. So, you don't have the root. And then, since q is 1, it's just the sum of differences of the components. So if you have binary vectors, 1 minus 0, that's 1. Absolute value, of course. 0 minus 1, it's also 1. 0 minus 0 is 0, and 1 minus 1 is 0. So you get the Hamming distance. So the sum of the differences of coordinates. So it's very important in the binary case, but you can use it in non-binary as well. On the other hand, the most often used is Euclidean distance because it's natural, something that we got used to in two dimensions. Okay? So Euclidean distance is the square root of the sum of squares. You don't need the absolute value because everything square is positive. So Euclidean distance is something that we are going to use. Of course, this is for equal length feature vectors. Now, if we are talking about unequal length feature vectors, when we talk about, usually talk about edit distance. And edit distance is something that we define after we first define what elementary edit operations are, in our case, deletions, insertions, substitutions. We have seen that when we talked about approximate search. Now, what is edit distance? It's the minimum number of elementary edit operations, which are these three, deletions, insertions, substitutions, needed to transform one vector into another. How do we get this? We have seen the matrix. So we compute that in an iterative way by filling the matrix of so-called partial edit distances or edit distance matrix, and then in the lower right corner of that matrix you get the distance. The definition can include some constraints. We mentioned some constraints in the search case as well. And here we can say that the total number of each elementary edit operations must not overcome this or that. That's one possible constraint. Or the maximum lengths of runs of elementary edit operations like deletions or insertions must not overcome something. No? So this is something that may be useful in some applications. But the normal definition of edit distance is unconstrained. So this allows us to compare vectors of different lengths. And here is an example with equal length vectors and Euclidean distance. An anomaly-based IDS monitors three parameters of a host, call them CPU usage, memory usage, and network usage. So you open your Windows system monitor, you get this. Now, observations of these parameters at 10 different time instances, T1 to T10, are, you see, every time you get three values. So CPU, memory, network, CPU, memory, network, etc., etc. So you have 10 feature vectors. So these are our feature vectors. So we have 10 feature vectors of length 3. Now, we want to cluster into two clusters. The initial centroids are V1 and V2. So if you get something like this on an exam, I must give you the centroids because otherwise everybody gets different results. So to get the same result, you have to get the same initial values. And that's what this is why. So the optimization is multimodal. So hill climbing, etc., etc., greedy algorithm. So if you take different initial centroids, you get different results in most cases. The distance is Euclidean. And we have to determine the clusters and the new centroids of the cluster after the first iteration. And then we are going to explain what happens next. So this is how k-means works. So we determine that V1 and V2 are centroids. Now for each of the vectors, except of V1 and V2, we have to compute the distance between this vector and the centroid, and then assign it to the closest centroid. So that's the first phase of the k-means. So for V3, you see, Euclidean distance means the square root of the sum of squares of the differences of the components. So V1 is 02, 04, 01, and V3 is 09, 07, 02. So we actually do that. 09 minus 02 squared. 07 minus 04 squared. 02 minus 01 squared. Sum of that, square root of that, we get 0.768. So that's the Euclidean distance between V3 and V1. Then we do that the same with V2. So the Euclidean distance between V3 and V2 is smaller. It's 0.1. And because of that, we assign V3 to the centroid V2, which means it will belong to the same cluster as V2. So we do that for the rest of the vectors. So V4, we get that it is also closer to V2. V5, also closer to V2. V6, closer to V2. But V7 is closer to V1. V8 to V1. And V9 to V1. And V10 to V1. So at the end of this procedure, we get two clusters. The first containing V1, V7, V8, V9, V10. And the second containing V2, V3, V4, V5, and V6. Now we move the centroids. The next step is calculation of the new centroids, and that's why it is called k-means. You have, in the first class, these vectors, V1, V7, V8, V9, and V10. We take the arithmetic mean of each component. And we get this vector, C1 prime, which will be the new centroid. So the old centroid was V1. And this was from the raw data set. Now, what we get is a new centroid that is not in the raw data set, but we don't care. The same thing for V2. So the first center was 090703, that was V2. And the new centroid for C2, the cluster C2, will be the mean, the arithmetic mean of each component, and they form the vector, which is C2 prime. So after one iteration of the k-means, we get the clustering obtained by assigning each vector to the closest centroid. And the new centroids, which are obtained by taking the arithmetic mean per coordinate of each member of each cluster. So that's k-means, very simple. What happens next? Repeat the procedure. So now we take all the vectors for V1 included and V2, so all the 10, and assign them to either C1 prime or C2 prime. Okay? Now, after that, we compute the new centroid, C1 secundum and C2 secundum. But before we proceed, we check whether any of these vectors have changed the cluster. If not, we have achieved the convergence and we stop, because there is not possible, it's not possible to change anything in the future. The thing is that empirically, this converges in most cases after four or five iterations, no matter how many vectors and what kind of vectors it is. After five iterations, there is a small change. In addition, it can be proved that this converges, always. Because the sum squared error can be shown to always fall. And if it always falls, sooner or later it falls to a minimum. Now, this is obviously linear. So we have to compute distance as many times as we have vectors each time. The thing is that it's too slow. If we have petabytes of vectors, of data, you never finish. So you have to do it even faster. So we are now going to consider the ways how we can make this even faster. Because still it's not efficient enough for anomaly-based intrusion detection system. Because we have to compute too many distances between the points and the centroids. And as we have seen, we have mentioned that for most points, after a very small number of iterations, say 4 and 5, they never change the cluster. Which means every computation of distance after 4th or 5th iteration is just not necessary. So we should avoid the distance calculations that are not needed. And this can be exploited to accelerate the k-means algorithm. And there are several ways. But all of them exploit this triangle inequality, the essential property of our metric. That's why we always have to check whether our distance, whatever, we cannot call it a measure if it is not a metric, so distance. Huh? So if it is a metric. If it is a metric, then the triangle inequality holds. And then we can speed up the k-means clustering this way. We can use these algorithms, compare means and sort means, which is a variant of compare means. Compare means is the essential part of it. Then the Elkins method, on which we are going to focus today, and then some methods that offer either not always improvement over Elkins method or very small improvement over the Elkins method. So we are going to concentrate on the Elkins method. But to explain Elkins method, we are first going to explain compare means, because Elkins method is actually based partially on this. So how can we speed up k-means by not computing the distances that are not necessary? Well, that's the question. We explain the compare means first. If x is a feature vector, we can call it a point. We said that the feature vector is a point in an n-dimensional space. And if c and c prime are two centroids. Now, if x is assigned to c, to the centroid c, in some iteration of k-means, to be assigned to c, we must have computed the distance between x and c, because we had to assign it to c somehow, and we assigned it on the base of the distance, because it was smaller to c than to c prime. So we know d of xc. Now we know c and c prime, so we can compute the distance between c and c prime. That's also possible. But we would like to avoid to compute the distance between x and c prime, because x now belongs to c, not to c prime. And if we use the classical k-means, next iteration would assume that you again compute the distance between x and c and x and c prime. So we would like to avoid this. How can we do that? We use triangle, you see. You have c, c prime, and x. So x is currently assigned to c, and we just write down this relation. So the distance between c and c prime must be less than or equal to the sum of these two distances, c, x, and x, c prime. And then we just transform this expression by moving the x, c to the left-hand side. So we have d of c c prime minus d of x c prime less than or equal to d of x c prime. Now we are saying this: if c prime is far away from c, then c must be closer to x than c prime, and we don't have to compute the distance between x and c prime. Now if you move this point further, you see, to the right, you intuitively conclude the same. But now the question is, where is the cutting point? So from where we guarantee this? So how far away must c and c prime be? So how much we have to move this c prime to the right to guarantee that x is closer to c than to c prime, which means that d of xc is less than or equal to d of xc prime. And if we know this, we don't have to compute that, because it will be less anyway in the next iteration. So we have this lemma 1, which says if 2d of xc is less than d or equal to d of cc prime, then d of xc is less than or equal to d of xc prime. So this is the condition. So if the distance between the centroids is twice as much as the distance between the x and 1 of those, then this is guaranteed. So you don't have to recompute it. The proof is easy. So if we say the condition holds, so 2d of xc is less than d of cc prime, we substitute d of cc prime with this 2d of xc in the relation that we have obtained, in this one. So instead of d of cc prime, we put 2d of xc. And why is that? Because you see, it's less than or equal, and instead of this, you put something that is less than or equal to this, and it must be less than or equal to that as well. Understand? So this is less than or equal to this, so left-hand side is less than or equal to the right-hand side, and on the left-hand side you have two components. One is fixed, d of xc, and one is variable. And instead of this variable part, you put something that is guaranteed to be smaller than it. If it is smaller than it, then it must be smaller than that one as well. So very simple. In that case, you just substitute d of cc prime with 2d of xc, but then you have 2d of xc minus d of xc, which is d of xc. So you get d of xc less than or equal to d of xc prime. Exactly what we needed. Which means, if this holds, 2d of xc less than or equal to d of cc prime, then d of xc is guaranteed to be less than or equal to d of xc prime, which means we don't have to compute d of xc prime next time. So we keep x in the cluster where it is in the next iteration. So that was our lemma 1, which we are going to exploit, well, which this author, Phillips, he exploited that to make this compare means algorithm. So we do not have to compute d of xc prime, because computation of the distance d of xc prime is n operations, where n is the length of the vectors, if they are of the same length. And computation of 2d of xc is just one operation, because we already have d of xc. It's just one multiplication. Actually, if it is 2d of xc, we shift left, which is actually multiplication with 2. So shifting left is extremely fast. So if we shift left, we get 2d of xc, and we just check this. Is it less than or equal to d of cc prime? If yes, the point x will not change the cluster in the next iteration. Otherwise, it will. And the method is called compare means. So we save some computation on this. Sort means is a variant of compare means where we have a lot of clusters. So we make a matrix, k times k, where k is more than 2, obviously, of centroid to centroid distance each time new centroids are calculated. Then we sort ascending. We don't have to do it, but it's even faster if it is sorted. When finding the closest centroid to the point x, we search centroids from the currently assigned centroid c to x, and if we find some for which the condition holds, then we know that it will remain in that cluster. So that's sort means. It is on average, of course, faster than compare means, but there is an overhead because we have to make this matrix and we have to sort, etc., etc. So it's faster from some k, say. If k is greater than, say, 10 or something, it will be faster. So it may be useful. But anyway, compare means is pretty fast. Now, this can be even faster with this Elkan's method that exploits partially, well, in its entirety, it exploits compare means, the lemma 1, but it adds another lemma, which is even easier to prove. But still, we can see that the method is pretty interesting. So we have x as a point, and c, the centroids x is assigned to at the beginning of the current iteration of k-means. And c prime is the new centroid at the end of this iteration. Okay? So in the compare means case, of course, c and c prime can be any centroids, but in Elkan's case, we are particularly focused on the centroid before the iteration and the centroid of the same cluster after the iteration. In the case of compare means, we are not saying that. We say that it is centroid of one cluster and c prime is centroid of another cluster. But the theory is the same. The triangle inequality is exploited the same way. But here in the Elkan's case, we are actually considering the centroid before the iteration and the centroid c prime after the iteration. So we are moving the centroid. C has moved to c prime. That's how we say. Since x is assigned to c in the current iteration, we know d of xc. That was the same as with compare means. And from the centroid before the iteration and the centroid after the iteration, they are known, so we can compute d of cc prime as well. to speed up k-means, we must be able to compute a lower bound for d of xc prime without explicitly computing d of xc prime. So that's our goal. How do we achieve this? We use the triangle inequality again, but we are now considered different. We are focused on different line of this triangle. So we are focused on d of xc. It must be less than or equal to d of xc prime plus d of cc prime. So before we were focused on this one, now we are focused on this one. But the triangle inequality also holds. So we have this lemma 2 that directly follows from this inequality. So we have that the d of xc prime is greater than or equal to d of xc minus d of cc prime. So this is something that we are going to exploit. You see, this is the lower bound for d of xc prime. The right-hand side is the lower bound. So the d of xc prime is greater than or equal to that. Now, Elkan's method uses both lemma 1, that was also used by Phillips in this compare means, and lemma 2, which is this one. Now we are going to show how. If x is a point and c and c prime are any two centroids, then by lemma 1, as we have seen before, we just rewrote it as instead of d of cc prime greater than or equal to 2d of xc, we just wrote it as 1 half of d of cc prime is greater than or equal to d of xc, which is the same. Now from this follows that d of xc prime is greater than or equal to d of xc. So it's guaranteed if this holds. And we don't have to compute d of xc prime because we shall know that it is greater than this one and we keep it in the same cluster. So that's what we had with application lemma 1 with compare means. Now, how do we use it in Elkan's method? Suppose we do not know the exact value of d of xc. This is very interesting. We only know some upper bound u for d of xc. So we know some value u that for which we know that it is greater than or equal to d of xc. As long as this u is less than or equal to 1 half of d of cc prime, we say, okay, we don't have to compute d of xc prime. If we take the minimum over all clusters, c prime that are not c, and get u always less than that, we know that x will remain in the cluster. So that's what we use in Elkan's method, you see? So we have to check whether there exists such u that is always less than or equal to this value, and this value we know exactly because we know c and c prime for all clusters. Now, suppose that it doesn't exist, that's another story. If you read the paper, you will see that in that case we shall have to explicitly compute d of xc. Now, how do we use lemma 2? This is even more interesting. If x is a point and c is the centroid x is assigned to at the beginning of the current iteration and c prime is the same but after or at the end of the current iteration. So we have moved the centroid a bit. Now, suppose we do not know the exact value of d of xc again, but we know some lower bound, call it L, for d of xc, for example. And we say, of course, since it is a lower bound, d of xc is greater than or equal to this lower bound L. So can we exploit that in avoiding to compute d of xc prime? We use lemma 2, which says d of xc prime greater than or equal to d of xc minus d of cc prime. That's by the triangle inequality. Now, we said this we don't know, but we know the lower bound of it. So it will be L minus T of C, C prime. We know lower bound of D of XC, sorry. So we can substitute D of XC. Instead of that, we write L. Why can we do that? Because this is greater than or equal, and we substitute this with something that is the same or less than that. So this is possible. Okay? So it's guaranteed that then d of xc prime will be greater than or equal to l minus d of cc prime. And we can call that l prime. So the only thing that we really need is the distance between c and c prime. We don't have to know the distance between x and c at all. We can use the lower bound instead. And from that calculation, we get the lower bound for d of xc prime. So instead of using the exact values of these distances, we use their lower bounds. And when we have a lower bound, it may be used in several iterations. That's the idea. So we save a lot of computation. We don't save only the computation on xc prime. We also save a computation between x and c distance. That's why Elkan's method is better than compare means. So informally, how do we explain this? If L was good enough approximation for d of xc, and c did not move too much at the end of the iteration, then L prime is also a good approximation for d of xc prime. In most cases, after a couple of iterations, this c prime will be very close to c. So it will not move too much. So this approximation is good enough. So this is exploited in the algorithm. We are not going to expose the algorithm, etc. It's not important. What is important is actually the essence of it. Why is it faster? So this is better than compare means because we not only save on calculation of the next iteration distance between x and c prime, but also this iteration instance of xc. We can use the lower bound of it. Good thing. So the main idea of this algorithm is instead of using the exact values of the distances of the points to the cluster centers, use their upper and lower bounds. Sometimes in the algorithm, it will be necessary to compute the exact values of d of xc. We have seen that we might find this u, but not always. Sometimes we shall not find them, so we have to compute the exact value of d of xc, but never of d of xc prime. This method is good in three aspects. First of all, the initialization method can be any. So whatever you use for initialization of classical k-means, you can use here. The most important is that given the same initial cluster centroids, it will produce absolutely the same partition as the standard k-means. Even though you don't compute any distance or almost any distance, you only use bounds. But still you get the same result. And it can use any metric. The only requirement is that it is a metric, which means triangle inequality, because this is exploited. Now, interestingly enough, it can be shown that eddy distance is also a metric. And you don't have to compare only equal length vectors, you can compare unequal length vectors and the same holds because of the triangle inequality. It's up to 50 times faster than the classical Lloyd's algorithm is actually, yes?
And also more memory consuming because you have to save the additional lower bound distance for each vector?
To some extent, but when you compute the distance, you also use memory.
Yes.
So you actually don't use that memory, you might use some other memory to memorize these upper and lower bounds. That's true. But anyway, what matters is the speed. We are confined to achieve as fast computation as possible because we need real-time operation and the memory is cheap. Yes, and it has been studied. So the analysis will show, you can read the original paper, the analysis shows that the memory consumption is not so important here. But you're right, it consumes some memory that the original algorithm didn't consume, but it doesn't consume some memory that it consumed. So that's you gain on one part and you lose on another. So it compensates. Now on the data sets that they used, he achieved 50 times faster operation than with, Lloyd's or Forgis algorithm. This is the one that is batch actually, if you read this paper, Lloyd's paper, this is not about clustering at all. It's about pulse code modulation, how you quantize the signal. Well, you are from the telecommunication branch, no? So digital signals, you sample them, you know?
So if this is a signal in time, something like that, you sample this to convert it to digital. Now PCM, pulse code modulation, says, okay, I'm going to sample the time signal in these points, I get these values. Now this is, say, 3 volts, this is 2 volts, this is 3 volts again, this is 4 volts. Now, I compute the binary representation of 2. 0, 1, 0. So this is code. This is pulse, this is code, and modulation is conversion between the analog and digital in this case. So it's digital modulation. So for this, now, to quantize this, I can say, okay, this value is close to, say, 2 volts, and this is to 4 volts, so instead of 3, I put it in this class. So this is classification of these values. So that's how they got that clustering is useful here. Use clustering to do this quantization. But he never mentions anything. In addition, it's one-dimensional signal. It's just one feature. Some small improvements of these Elkan methods are Hamerly's method and Drake's and Hamerly's method. We are not going to talk about this. So you don't have to use many lower bounds. You can use just one. And this is Hamerly's method, even faster than this one, not much. And Drake's and Hamerly's method, you can vary the number of lower bounds. So you save some memory, you get some speed, etc. But these are details. And in addition to that, we have already mentioned some newer algorithms. The last one is from 2015 by the same authors, Drake and Hamerly. So people are working on this, and it is significant today because of this big data. So it has to be as fast as one can do. Now, all this story because of anomaly detection. Offline, as we said, can be made very fast. We have seen that by means of this triangle inequality and some other methods. In addition, there are approximate methods. So they will not get the same result as the original k-means, but they will get it faster. So they may get some other local minimum or close to the local minimum, and they are also faster. But we concentrated on those that get the same results as the classical k-means. So if we use the speed-up methods based on the triangle inequality, we get almost real-time operation of the IDS. Since it's batch, it's never real-time operation. It's lagging behind, but not much. We may implement it in a parallel way on distributed architectures, MapReduce. So one of the methods is from this year. So IEEE that Datacom conference, you find it in Blackboard. You can read it. If you are interested, I have defined a master thesis on this. So this is about general. They don't think about intrusion detection. So do this in intrusion detection and you get your master thesis. And at the end, we talk about labeling, because what you get from the clustering is actually something that the clusters will not tell you which one is good, which one is bad. So you get, for example, 2 clusters in our case, and it just said vectors V1, 7, 8, 9, 10, they belong to the cluster 1, and the rest belong to the cluster 2. But which one is good, which one is bad traffic? It will not tell you. It cannot tell you because it's unlabeled data. Now the question is, which cluster is good and which cluster is bad? And we call this process labeling clusters. It has been studied from the very beginning of the application of clustering and
non-parametric methods in intrusion detection, in anomaly detection in particular. And the first assumption was this one. Normal is the cluster of the greatest cardinality. So if you have five clusters, the one that is biggest is normal traffic. And why is that? Because intuitively, most of the traffic is normal. Well, why not? Now, what if we have a massive or a burst attack? We have seen flood and we take batch processing as we are doing now. We take 1,000 vectors, each of them in seen flood. There is no normal traffic there. So we get one cluster of 1,000 vectors and the other empty, and the big one is attack. It's not normal. So this fails miserably in the case of burst attacks. And that's our problem. So what else can we do? If this doesn't work, we can use analysis of the structure of the classes. And for this, we can use clustering quality criteria. And some of them are listed here on the slide 65. Silhouette index, Davis quality index, Dunn's index, clusters diameters. That's not the clustering quality criterion, but it is used in combination with these indexes. Yes?
Can we just test it?
What?
Can we just test this, let's say, cluster? We launch an attack, we know it's an attack, and see where the cluster is used?
Yes, but you don't know whether it is an attack or not. That's the point. So the clustering will not tell you. So you get a pile of vectors in one cluster, a pile of vectors in another cluster, and you don't know which one is which. You cannot do it. One is big, one is small, but still the big one can be attack. That's what I'm saying. So if it is like this, seen flood or some flood attack, then you have a big cluster of attacks, not of normal traffic.
But a cluster, isn't it from also the past data? So it's a lot of data there?
You can use some other methods to tell. Not clustering. That's true. You can combine with misuse detection or something, or manual inspection.
What I mean, the data of the clusters, where accurate is it from the time? Is it just for this second, or is it for the whole time the system is in...
No. It's just for the last, say, m vectors. So okay. It may be a couple of seconds or something. I'll show you an example at the end. And we are going to talk about that particular data later in one of the lectures that follows. So, we actually are going to combine one of these indexes, like silhouette index or Davis-Baldwin or Dunn's index, with the cluster's diameter. So, that's one of the combinations that we have used to analyze the structures of the cluster on the basis of this analysis to conclude whether this is an attack or a good cluster. For this to define, we need intra-cluster distance and inter-cluster distance. So intra-cluster is the measure of compactness of a cluster, how small actually the diameter is of this cluster. And inter-cluster is the measure of separation between the clusters. And here are some variants. We are going to mention them again. In our example that we have been using in our research, we have used the Davis-Baldwin index, and we have combined it with one variation of this intra-cluster distance, the compactness measure. We are going to say that. So the data set for clustering is the set X containing X1, X2, etc., etc., Xn. So these are our feature vectors. We cluster them into k clusters, C1, C2, to Ck. The distance between two vectors, Xi and Yj, is d of Xi, Yj. Whatever distance we define, no problem. So this is general. So we cluster into k clusters. The distance measure is defined. The data set for clustering contains m feature vectors. Then the Davis-Baldwin index is defined this way. So db of c, c is the clustering, so the set of clusters. So it will be 1 divided by the number of clusters times the sum, but each component of this sum is the maximum of, you take two clusters, for example C1, C2, and then big delta is the intra-cluster distance. So you compute the intra-cluster distance of the first one and the intra-cluster distance of the second one and divide by the inter-cluster distance. So that would be, in the k-means case, it would be the distance between the centroids. Okay? So you take that, for example, if you have five clusters, you take 1, 2, 1, 3, 1, 4, 1, 5, 2, 3, 2, 4, 2, 5, etc., etc., and find the maximum that you find out of all them, and that's one component of the sum. And then for each cluster, because you have one cluster, for this you have the intercluster, etc., etc. So maximum of this. And then the intra-cluster distance is defined, in our case, as centroid diameter. We could use something else, but centroid has been shown, or has been chosen. Why? Because we would like to use k-means, and for this it's very convenient to use centroid, because there we have centroids. So delta of some cluster, big delta, is, you see, 2, and then the sum of all vectors in this cluster, their distance to the centroid, divided by the cardinality. This is the number of vectors in the cluster. Why 2? Because it's diameter, it's not radius, so it's like a circle. And the mean is actually, you take every coordinate, compute the arithmetic mean, and then divide by the cardinality of the cluster. So that's really what we do. The intercluster is centroid linkage, which is actually just the distance between centroids. Now, this defined, we can make some kind of heuristic to study the structure of these clusters. Other possibilities, in addition to these, we can use for intercluster distance like complete diameter, average diameter, or for intercluster distance we could use, as we have mentioned before, with hierarchical clustering, single linkage, complete linkage, every linkage. There are many measures of this kind, so we can try this as well, but we have used centroid diameter, centroid linkage, and the Davis-Bolding index. Now, why am I talking about this? Because this has been a topic of research, and in the good old days when I was doing this, we have made the heuristic for two clusters only. So that works pretty much, we are pretty well, we are going to see some examples. So we combine Davis-Bolding index of the clustering and the centroid diameters of the cluster. So we compute the Davis-Bolding and we look at the centroid diameters of the cluster, combine these two pieces of information and conclude about whether the cluster is good or bad. We have two clusters, one is good and one is bad, normal or non-attack, and abnormal or attack. So I suggest that we continue because we have like 5 minutes and then we finish for the day. Okay? So the main idea is attack vectors are often mutually very similar, if not identical, if we are talking about flood. Syn flood has all the vectors same, as an example. So the attack cluster consequently is, in this case of a burst attack, very, very compact. Just one point. The distances are all zero. Then, if we do have a burst attack, the Davis-Bolding index of such a clustering is very small. So it may be zero if non-attack cluster is empty or very close to zero. So we may have, out of 1,000 vectors that we clustered, all the vectors in attack cluster, so then the non-attack cluster is empty, in which case the Davis-Bolding index is zero. So the expected value of the centroid diameter in such a case is smaller for the attack cluster than for the non-attack cluster. Why? Because it's compact. So every attack vector is either very similar to the others or exactly the same. Then, the small values of the Davis-Bolding index will indicate the existence of a burst attack. So we first compute that. If we get a small value under some threshold, then we say this must be a burst attack. or a massive attack. In that case, a small value of the centroid diameter indicates the attack area. So if it is a flood, and we have two clusters of which one is very compact and one is not compact, then this very compact must be an attack. Now, the other way around, a high value of a Davis-Bolin index indicates that there is no burst attack. In this case, we have normal traffic and we have attacks coming occasionally. And these attacks may be similar, but not likely. So it may be today, maybe buffer overflow, tomorrow port scanning, so they have nothing in common. You see, they are not so similar. On the other hand, if you visit web pages, read the newspapers, etc., etc., so you visit web pages that are similar to some extent, you see. You're doing things that are more similar than somebody that attacks you from Africa and from Asia and from Australia, not knowing each other, and just script kid is playing, launching attacks and trying to find vulnerable hosts. Of course, this can be criticized because you may do random things as well. That's possible. But we cannot encompass everything with one heuristic. This is a heuristic, it's not an algorithm. So it will actually, in most cases, work. So in this case, if you don't like this, you can even count the vectors, because cardinality works in this case if it is not a burst. So this is an additional check. So the algorithm for cluster labeling is like this. A clustering of n vectors into two clusters, C1 and C2. And by default, C1, we consider that it is non-attack. Now, this may be wrong. So the algorithm actually relabels data if necessary. If this assumption is good, then it will not do anything. But if this assumption is bad, if you put bad vectors into a cluster that you call good, then you have to relabel. That's the idea of the algorithm. You have to set some threshold for Davis-Bolden, because we said it, if the Davis-Bolden value is small, then it's a burst. So we have to determine how small. And you may, but you don't have to, set some centroid diameter difference threshold, delta CD1 and delta CD2, so you may introduce some tolerance into comparison of centroid diameters. So in our experiments, we put this to be zero, but it may be introduced as well. The output is the same clustering, but may be relabeled. So what was one is now two, and what was two is now one. So the algorithm may do the relabeling, but may not. It depends whether the conditions are met. And here is the algorithm on the slide 76. So we first compute the Davis-Bolden index for the clustering. We compute the centroid diameter for the first cluster, the centroid diameter for the second cluster. And then we may have three cases. We first check whether the Davis-Bolden index is exactly zero. And then if it is zero, what happens? This is the case one. The Davis-Bolden zero means that the sample to cluster only contain very similar feature vectors of a burst attack. Now CD2 equal to zero means that this cluster is empty. And that should not be the case. It should be opposite. So this cluster should be full of vectors and the other one should be empty. So we have to relabel. So that's the case one. The case two is this one. So if Davis-Bolden is high, big value over the threshold, and the CD1, the diameter of the cluster that is considered normal, is greater than the diameter of the cluster considered abnormal, plus maybe some tolerance, but this is not important. So consider this zero, then you just have CD1 greater than CD2. Then we have this case two. So dB greater than delta dB indicates a sample that doesn't contain a massive or flood or burst attack. And then this CD1 greater than CD2 plus some tolerance indicates that this CD1 is less compact than CD2. as we said in our discussion, that should not be the case. So if you are a user, you probably, if you're visiting web pages, you probably visit something that is related. So they should be more compact than isolated attacks coming from different continents. So that shouldn't be the case. Well, this is the weakest link in our heuristic, because this depends on the user. So if you really are a randomly wandering user, that should fail. Anyway, if not, that will work, and you will have to relabel, because this cluster CD1 that is normal, whose diameter is CD1 that is normal, should be more compact than the attack cluster, because the attacks are not related. They are not flood attacks. Finally, we have the third case in which we have a small Davis-Bolin index and the compactness of CD2 smaller, or its diameter larger than the diameter of the non-attack proclaimed cluster. In which case we have this case 3, where the small dB, Davis-Bolin value, indicates a sample that contains burst attack traffic. And CD2, that's the diameter of the attacks, of the attack cluster, the cluster that we call attack cluster, is greater than the diameter of the cluster that we call non-attack. That shouldn't be a case. So if it is a flood, then this diameter should be small. So we relabel. So that's the whole philosophy. We have three cases, of which the first one is special, when we only have attack vectors, none normal. And we are going to talk a lot about this KDD CUP 1999 data set. It was a simulated military air-based traffic back in 1998 and 99, where they simulated some client servers, some attacks, etc., etc., and they had many vectors in this database, each of them having 41 features. And these were feature vectors to classify. Now, in some portions of this database, we don't have any attacks. For example, in this first 1,000 vectors, we don't have any intrusion. Or here, between 5 and 6,000, these are ordinal numbers of the records. We don't have any intrusion. But sometimes we have some intrusion vectors, and sometimes we only have intrusion vectors. Now, how did our algorithm behave? First of all, we first have to cluster by means of k-means. So we got some clustering, and this clustering was with bad labeling, like here, or good labeling, like here. We know that because there is a 42nd feature that is a label. So this is a label data set. We just ignore that 42nd feature. This test data set is good because it is labeled. We can check our algorithms on it. The bad thing with it is that it is outdated. So it characterizes some traffic that is very, very old. So, in which case, if it is not good labeling by the very clustering algorithm, then we have to relabel. So our heuristic was using some cases here. So that would be the case number 2. That would be the case number 3, relabeling, and that would be the case number 1. You see, only attacks. So that's the case number 1. And here, there was a burst attack, but there was some normal attack, either before or after that, probably before. So you have 700 or 600 normal vectors, and then suddenly a lot of attack vectors, but all very similar. So we can browse through that database and see exactly what kind of attack it was, because it's labeled. So in this case, we have the case number 3. But here, the clustering obtained the good labeling. So you don't have to relabel. So that's the case 0, non-label. So the algorithm, the heuristic, will not do anything. And of course, here are the values that were computed first in the heuristic. So first the Davis-Bolin index, then CD1 and CD2. Now we had Davis-Bolin index high, but CD1 greater than CD2. That shouldn't be a case if there is an attack. So we have relabeling, etc., etc. So that will be all for today. Well, we finished before 1 o'clock. So. So if anybody is interested in clustering, doing for the master thesis, I would be really happy to help you. So see you on Tuesday. We talk about machine learning.
It's interesting how many topics you accessors thrive with intrusion detection systems.
Yeah, as we said, intrusion detection, it's especially anomaly detection, it's everything. Biology as well. Everything has been tried.